If they did, heck, that'd be beautiful. But we're not there. I don't know if anyone else wants to comment on.
No, I agree.
Well, there are a variety of new storage architectures being built, and all kinds of new devices, and the device level, the cell level,
we're still waiting for holograph storage.
Yeah, and the 3D storage. Yeah.
This is really an issue in that, usually when you have in a situation where you're unhappy with your current technology, it's nice when you already have something in the lab that's already the consensus that next generation technology is going to take it over. Yeah. And I don't think we have that for disk drives today.
No.
I don't think we have that for CPUs today. I mean, CMOS is here. It's going to be around for a while. I mean, we don't have a consensus for what's next.
I think we're stuck with RAM and disks.
Yeah,
for a long time.
That is a little worrisome. Yeah. As a long term, especially when you consider energy issues that were mentioned earlier.
Yeah, exactly.
There seems to be a growing consensus that phase change memory, the Ovonic memory or whatever, will be the next generation. It's a tentative and maybe precarious consensus, but it embraces everybody from Samsung and Micron to Intel, which it's probably 5 years or more away, but it is coming and will change the situation. There are different architectures of storage architectures that are being developed that are supposedly allow you to put petabytes in a small box. And if Andy Bechtolsheim was supposed to be here at one point, and he believes that the changes in computer architecture are moving faster than they understand at Google, and that in fact these big data centers by big dams are going to be increasingly obsolescent, maybe faster than expected, because of all the computer architecture, the optical communications, the ongoing onrush of technical advance in the telecosm.
I think it's still a safe bet that Google's building out those data centers, though.
I think
that's still a smart thing for them to do.
Yeah, right. Well, that's what I concluded. Yeah. But still, what's your...
I've talked to Andy about this, and I think to Luz's point as well, the issue is not, storage is increasing. These problems are being solved within a data center, but the store width issue is still there. The bandwidth bottleneck, 10 gig is still not cheap enough to stamp onto every motherboard on every machine. And we were talking in one particular conversation with Andy about, say a box in 4U that's got something like 48 terabytes. And I said, yeah, so, and he's talking to people that say, hey, we want to put 1,000 of these out there. And I said, well, I'm going to have to compute the bandwidth required and the cost of that bandwidth required to seat all those. He says, oh, no, you're going to preload that and then ship them out FedEx because that's cheaper. And that's a store width problem. Yeah. And I think we're still going to have that for some time to come simply because the rate of change in the machines and within the data center is faster than the rate of change in the networks.
Yeah.
2007 will be a huge year, finally, for OC768 in a number of big networks. And that's going to get us to 40 gig. We're exhausting the parallelism at 10 gig that can be used to efficiently plumb the internet. And even 40 gig, I've been participating on the efforts to get 100 gig E adopted, and that's not happening fast enough.
Andy is building 10 gig silicon, right? He's got 4 gig on his Galaxy boxes today, and he wants to be able to put multiple 10 gig parts.
Yeah, that's correct.
So he wants 40 gig coming out the back end of a Opteron 8-way server, right?
So I think these provide an opportunity for redistribution of computer power. I mean, if all these crises are afflicting the data center, the cost effectiveness of the data center will no longer increase with Grotius' law, and you actually will find a new diaspora, new dispersion of computing power to the edges again. And this is...
I was going to mention, I mean, the 10 gig E is sort of adoption issue, sort of an interesting point in that. I mean, I see it both as a part of a solution and a big part of a problem. And let me see if I can articulate what I think the problem behind that is that the endpoint bandwidth, you know, the network interface chip or card that's on a computer, and the affordability of that is certainly an issue, right? And once that goes down, then you begin to be able to take that technology seriously for sort of large scale deployment. My concern right now is that even at 1 gig E rates, if you have a very large number of machines, the switching gear itself to be able to provision high bisection bandwidth really to all of these machines. Say you have 10,000 machines, which Google is reported to have. and you actually want all of these machines to talk to each other at 1 gig E, not 10 gig E, 1 gig E. Try to go buy a switch that will allow you to get the 10 terabits per second of bisection bandwidth that you'd like for that. First, you can't find, or maybe Cisco might be able to sell you one, I'm sure, but I'm not sure how big their AGFR switches are. But second, you won't be able to afford it, I guarantee you that.
Yeah. Right?
And that's actually the key problem, is that at the endpoints, at the network interface card, maybe at the small switch, and at the server level, economies of scale and commodity components are helping those being affordable. But on the big switching side of the world, that's a completely different world. It's a completely different market, and the economics in that market and the incentives there are not towards very efficient switching. Yeah. So you can't afford the 1 gig E switch today, and I lose sleep at night at what's going to happen when there's actually all the machines trying to pump 10 gig E into that switching infrastructure that can't take.
So what's the answer, Lane?
Have you ever even tried to wire those things? Talk about spaghetti.
Yes.
And that's another reason to go to 10 gig as opposed to lots of 1 gigs. And another reason why we need 100 gig as opposed to lots of 10 gigs.
Well, see, I mean, it's not an argument. I wasn't trying to actually. I was trying to point out that, once you solve that problem, we have to figure out how to solve that other one, because otherwise, really don't actually address this issue
fully. I think what you're seeing is the fact is that the rate of change in the solution sets around those problems is slower than the rate of change at which, server bandwidth is increasing, storage is increasing, memory is increasing.
Well, so, the NICs are getting faster than the switches. Yep. I mean, that's the problem.
And the additional problem that you layer on top of that is, along with all of that speed, comes density, comes heat, and now all of the infrastructure required to facilitate that is not. So you talk, Lane spoke of the difference between the speed with which the hardware versus the network. That disparity is even greater in terms of evolution of equipment with. On the infrastructure side. So we're not seeing, until we start to move out of traditional sorts of cooling with air and that sort of thing and move to water-chilled servers, et cetera, there's going to be a continued gap between the cutting-end technology and the age-old chillers that haven't changed fundamentally in design in the last 25 years. Mm-hmm. That's got to be addressed as well.
Well, I've heard rumblings that Google has their own skunkworks around optical interconnect and other issues to solve this problem, but the guys I talk to at companies like Infinera or Force 10 or whatnot, they're still at a point of, for us to get where we need to be in terms of density for the interconnect and switches and the affordability, we have to go to 20 gig serial lines, copper serial lines across the backplane. We're at 10 gig serial today. And we have to have a density of those such that we can do 400 to 500 gig per slot on these chassis. And they still see that to be 2 to 3 years out to get there, which is really disappointing.
This is Infinera.
Yeah, and
who will be here? But.
Right, and not to mention the fact that, as you said, the BTUs that come out of that is pretty disheartening, and we're still years away probably from having an optical interconnect at a chip level, which could solve that.
Where are the design centers that are focused on this set of problems? Because it really is relatively new that we would try to architect computing and storage hierarchies to deal with these kinds of massively scaled services.
Well, they've been working on this stuff for, 15, 20 years. I think the problem is that it's never become a commodity issue, ever. In those two decades that people have been building clusters, the interconnect is always a big deal. And guess where they go to get the interconnect? They go to proprietary interconnect companies and get a Quadrix set, or they don't use Ethernet. They get a very high-end system, and the problem is you don't have people running shared nothing clusters in their basements, and so you don't have a mass market, so it doesn't get cheap and commoditized. And what's interesting, and we're a little worrisome, is that will continue. The trend will continue, and we'll always be just a few years away from getting what we need to get the economics where they need to be at to make it economical for companies like Google and Ask and Yahoo. What's happened with the computing revolution around clustering is, hey, we can take this commodity stuff. This stuff's fast enough to build it into clustering. What we're finding is, okay, the processors are there, we can deal with the disks, the memory's there. Oh, crud, the networking, that's not keeping up.
So is this ultimately Cisco Juniper's problem?
It's just, it's just not a market. It's a market issue. How many, like Louis said, you can buy one, right? Because how many customers need it? Like seven. And so they're not going to invest in it. Yeah. And so we're stuck with just trying to build, with Tinker Toys out of these low-end stuff, trying to enable high-end clusters. And, well, that's really hard.
Is Sand Hill Road on the problem? Are there a bunch of startups that are working this?
Well, I'm sure there's been billions of dollars invested in really high-end terabit optical routers, but again, the Sand Hill Road doesn't create markets. They just pump money into things that might become a market, and we haven't seen a mass market for terabit routers. And I dare say that
maybe this will be one. Question from the...
Yeah, hi, I'm Sue Kunz from Solidware. And my question has to do with the actual computer architecture behind these large data systems, or I'm sorry, data centers. The question is, are we talking about, large way SMP machines, pizza boxes, blades, some combination thereof? And what do the memory subsystems need to look like to support everything from high-performance computing all the way to transactional processing?
Dane, do you want to, or Louis?
More pizza boxes than anything, without getting into too much detail. The challenge for us is not the number of processors we can fit into a box, but rather the number of boxes we can fit into a data center. That's the challenge. That's where I spoke of on the infrastructure back end. That's where the bottlenecks are for us. So. In some cases, blades, in fact, aren't a good solution because they're just even more dense, and they're even more. We've all moved away from two-U servers to one-U servers, but yet you look at a two-U server, and the great thing about it is you can put nice big fans in it that rotate at a lower speed and consume less energy, as opposed to a one-U that has like seven or eight hairdryer-sized fans that are sucking a lot of power. So. There's the trade-off isn't so much between, at least in our case, between the number of processors we can stuff in a box, but the number of boxes.
Well, the blade servers are sort of playing a shell game, aren't they? Mm-hmm. I mean, because it's like, hey, what do you do? You it still takes the same amount of power, and it makes the same amount of heat, and requires the same amount of cooling, and the same number of ports for a switch, and you just save a little bit of real estate. But real estate's, you can go up to Idaho and get a lot of real estate for cheap. But guess what? Power is kind of, and 20-ton Liebert systems are still, it's just a little shallow.
We need better good put for what?
Uh-huh.
The way I would answer that question is that let's look at what's affordable. Because at the end of the day, if you have a very large-scale system, it will have to use a lot of CPUs, it will have to use a lot of computers. And the specific details of the architecture of any one of these building blocks can be relevant, but it's not as important as the affordability and the efficiency of the entire solution. And the entire solution means, you know, the whole thing that's inside, you know, the brick walls, right? Everything that's inside the building. So the mentality, I think, for lots of us here is not one of building a machine, but it's really, you know, building, you know, a data center, right? Yep. Our machine is this brick and mortar thing with, you know, sort of four walls and a roof. And what's more efficient at that scale? If you look now to go a little bit more micro into what your question is trying to address, for the CPU side of things, there will be multi-core architectures, and because it's the only thing we can do with CMOS these days. Our group, way back 10 years ago, actually did one of the first research prototypes of this, and we thought it was a great idea for performance. We had no idea it was such a great idea for power as well. We weren't that smart. But that's what's going to happen. Clearly, if you already need thousands of machines, the fact that, you know, or thousands of CPUs, the fact that now you have 8 or 16 of them on the chip doesn't necessarily change your programming model necessarily that radically. From a memory system standpoint, it's more of an issue of keeping those units fed. There's only so much you can do with very large caches, so reducing latency to the memory system is very important. I'm less concerned about memory throughput than I think many people are these days. But you never know. If we go berserk on the number of cores on a die, suddenly we may be in a situation where we're throughput limited.
I think all of the architectures that we subscribe to are all basically NUMA. I mean, once you've been able to...
NUMA,
the non-uniform memory architecture. So it's basically in a shared nothing system where you have individual computers and they're attached by some interconnect like a network. And that's your platform. And we all program to that platform because that's how you scale as big as we need to scale. Once you've kind of got a handle on that programming model, like Louis said, it doesn't matter so much about the block. Right? It's just another piece of your NUMA machine. The hard transition is going from a shared memory architecture like an SMP and making that leap to the shared nothing. Once your programming model can make that leap, you're free and you're open, and then you start thinking, okay, let me think about the data center. Let me think about heat, let me think about power, let me think about latencies, you know, bisection bandwidth, that sort of thing. But I think that's the big chasm. You know, and once you cross that,
any more questions?
This is an investment question.
Hi, my name is Chris Harrison. This is an investment question. I'm not going to ask Luis to answer this because he indicated that wasn't his forte. But above and beyond that, if you do know the answer to this, you won't be able to answer it. I'll ask Mark what he thinks. I was sitting at a bar in New York City recently, and I was eavesdropping on someone's conversation. And it was really quite a conversation. And this person was speaking very passionately.
This is called insider trading, by the way.
Exactly.
There's a name for that.
The person said that this was a done deal. I want to see if you think this is likely or not. Google will buy Sun. They will buy the low-end systems, the software and the services. They might buy the storage. If they don't buy the storage, EMC is going to take the storage, and either Fujitsu or Hewlett-Packard or Hitachi was going to take the high-end servers. And then they were going to do some kind of joint agreement with Apple and create an extraordinary competitive opportunity against Microsoft. Now, the funny thing is, after I heard this conversation, I didn't interject, I just listened. I went and checked out a couple of blogs, and sure enough, there's some stuff floating around out there. And then I noticed that the share volume jumped from 45 million shares a day to about 70 to 90 million shares a day for several weeks. So I'm just curious, is that a possibility?
Anything is possible. For instance, Dell cannot continue as the company they currently are. They must do something significant. Dell could easily merge with EMC next week.
Why is that? What would that do?
That would give Dell intellectual property and innovation and wouldn't require them to build their own R&D department, which they can't do. Or alternately, because both Dell and Apple are now Intel's ponies, they could, because Apple really wants to be a software and services company and not a PC company, we could see the rumors that Dell is in discussion to license Macintosh architecture. We could see Dell start to build Macintoshes. I did have a conversation with Scott McNeely a couple of weeks ago. Scott is big, as you probably all know, on the topic that only three survive. And I said to him, you've convinced me only three survive. That means you don't. So in some sense, there is no long-range reason for Sun. It so happens at this moment in time, relative to their main competitors, they're the most innovative. They're driving to interesting customer areas. They've actually got great business prospects. So I've just made a round of investor calls. There's enormous interest about Sun out there. There was a big rotation in ownership late last year. Some people got sick and tired of waiting. Value investors stepped up. So is Sun in play? Perhaps. There's a lot of interesting business going on there. I believe this industry is going to be significantly restructured over the course of the next couple of years. And so topics like that are now very much on the minds of investors. Whether that one happens or some of the others I've just suggested, we're going to see some big events.
That Eric Schmidt went on the board of Apple just recently as well.
Yes, and John Dvorak wrote a column saying that meant that Apple and Sun were going to merge, and Scott's reaction was characteristically, what is he smoking?
Any other questions? Okay, well, we've settled that there's a new computer architecture, and it's afflicted with many problems, and it provides an opportunity for companies that want to overthrow it.
I agree to that.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the Chairman of the Board, President and CEO Finisar, Mr. Jerry Rawls.
Well, thank you very much. I want to accomplish a couple of things today. I suspect we're one of those companies that an awful lot of you here today have never heard of, so I'd like to correct some of that while I'm at it. I'd like to talk some about this. Lane talked about in the prior panel the need for 100 gigabits, and we're one of those companies in optical space that are on the way to 100 gigabits. And I'm going to help you understand, I think, from our perspective as an optics company, that optics are back, and they really are back. I think you've heard, you know, part of the theme of this conference is all about bandwidth. We heard from the prior group the need for more and more bandwidth in our networks. If I've got to get something here that changes the, does that do it? There we go. So, a little bit about Finisar, the company that you might not have heard of. We are the number one supplier of optics to the high-speed networking industry. So for all the storage, Ethernet, non-telecom kind of space, we're the number one supplier in the world. We ship 2.5 million optical transceivers. That's a combination of a transmitter and a receiver last quarter. At data rates over a gigabit, anywhere from 1 gigabit to 40 gigabits. And that's the equivalent of 1 megabit per second of bandwidth for every person on Earth last quarter. So we're doing our best to try to fill up these networks and provide really high-speed connectivity between the switches, the servers, and the storage. Our company is traded on the NASDAQ under the symbol of FNSR. We have 4,200 employees located in the U.S. and California and Texas, in Malaysia, China, and Singapore. Our revenues this year will be about $450 million. And it's for us, it's been a comeback. The optics industry in general went through a terrible downturn in the 2000-2001 period, where it was the collapse of the internet economy, the collapse of the post Y2K, and the collapse of the telecom expansion. But we have come back strongly from that. Our company has had now 12 consecutive quarters of quarter over quarter revenue growth, the last 8 of which have been record revenues for the company. And we've had, importantly for us and our shareholders, we've had the last 4 quarters we have been profitable. So we have been really making progress as the demand for storage and the demand for bandwidth are now really stronger than it has ever been. The products we make mostly are optical plug-ins. They're optical transceivers, and they plug into boxes that, let's see, I hope I can go backwards on this thing. You can see the ports, you can see the yellow cables or the optical fibers, and where they end up is in an electronic box that has merely an electronic output. We convert that electronic output to an optical pulse so we can launch light into the fibers to connect the switches, the servers, and the storage. I want to go backwards. How do I go backwards? Right there. So that optical transceiver you can think of as the optical plug-in, and as I said, we made 2.5 million of them last quarter that we sold to all of the big manufacturers of switches, storage arrays, host bus adapters, servers, etc. And they enable their boxes to communicate one to another. The critical elements of these devices are in the picture at the bottom, where you can see we have a laser where we convert the electronic signal coming in from the switch or from the host system to an optical pulse that we then have to focus into a fiber. And then we have a receiver section, a photodetector on the other side that receives the transmission from the box that's on the other end of that fiber and converts it into electronic signal and hands it back to the host system. So our challenge as a company is to be able to build lasers that are fast enough, photodetectors that are fast enough, and design and have made ICs, the laser drivers, the transimpedance amplifiers, the post amps, and the digital control chips that are all part of this stack up. As I pointed out, we are the endpoint. If you follow those fibers from wherever that make up the network, for all of the network providers, at the end of the fiber comes one of our optical plugins. So we're plugged in right on the front of those boxes. But as all the panelists in the prior panel told us, we are limited in the bandwidth in all these networks. And so one of the focuses right now is where we are supplying literally millions of 1 gigabit optics, a lot of 2 gigabit and 4 gigabit optics for storage, now thousands and thousands of 10 gigabit optics for Ethernet networks. The focus is the next horizon, and it's 100 gigabit Ethernet. Moore's Law, as we've heard earlier today from one of the speakers, it's all about how the processors and double their processing speed and the number of components on board every year and a half. Well, if you do the arithmetic, that says that every 5 years you increase your processing speed by a factor of 10. Well, in the optical space, that's about what we've been doing. If you look at Ethernet, in 1995 we were at 100 megabit, In 2000, we were at a gigabit. At 2005, we were 10 gigabit Ethernet. And now we're really focused on that next 5 years. About 2010, we're going to be at 100 gigabit Ethernet. The hope is that when we get to 100 gigabit Ethernet, that in fact, Ethernet will be ubiquitous. The SONET networks that we think of today in the telephony world, in many, many cases, will have been replaced by 100 gigabit Ethernet and IP networks everywhere, with everything and all the information for phones and video and entertainment, et cetera, all being delivered over IP network at these 100 gigabit speeds. So we in optics have really very much been following Moore's law throughout this process. Our worldwide network is filling up. One of the things that we heard from the panelists prior was all about some of the constraints in the data centers that they build. Not all of them had to do with connectivity and bandwidth, but that sure was part of it. But there are phone companies today that all of those fibers that they put in place back in the 90s, some of them are filled up. And believe it or not, they're now putting pressure on to try to expand the number of wavelengths that are on those networks, the speed at which data is connected on each one of those networks. And so it is all about that relentless pressure that we just have to be able to move more and more data because the data is piling up. Data storage, the information that's being stored that has now to be communicated is piling up. A lot of our focus is on, as a networking equipment company supplier, big enterprise data centers. One of our customers is one of the big financial services companies in America. They have tens of petabytes of storage in their data centers. And no, they're not a Google or a search engine, but they serve tens of millions of clients in their 401k plans, their benefits plans, their brokerage accounts, their retirement, asset allocation, et cetera. And this year, it took them 15 years to build this more than 10 petabyte storage network. In this year, they will double it. That's pretty amazing. And what drives it is online experience with those tens of millions of customers. All those clients have to have all their financial records forever online, instantly accessible now. And they have to have this wonderful, colorful and seamless experience with the graphical user interface that's provided by the company. So it's pretty amazing in terms of the growth in storage and therefore the growth in bandwidth that's required to move all this data. 100 gigabit Ethernet, what's it all about? Well, yeah, you can move a DVD from point to point in a half a second. Well, that's pretty impressive. And a 100 gigabit Ethernet can carry 5,000 channels of HDTV simultaneously, or you could do 1.5 hours of HDTV download in a second. It's a very impressive pipe, and believe me, the networks that we have today will be much relieved if we can provide pipes that are that large. The drivers for all of this bandwidth and the 100 gigabit are, yes, it's all about what we've heard of from the Google guys, but in addition, it's Cisco where it is the network is the platform, and it's Sun where it's the network is the computer. And it's all about video everywhere. Video and the quad play of video, voice, internet, and mobility. And having video in your hand everywhere you go that you can watch any TV or download any video that you want from YouTube or whatever. It is just amazing in terms of how it is driving the bandwidth for us and the bandwidth requirements for these networks. And beyond that is all a number of unseen or unknown applications where application providers and application programmers are going to follow Parkinson's law, because if the pipes are there, if they're big enough, they're going to develop the applications to fill them up. For us, 100 gigabit Ethernet is a challenging problem. We heard earlier on one of the panels, they talked about how the cost of 10 gigabit Ethernet is too high. Well, it is high. It has been more than 10 times the cost of 1 gigabit Ethernet because the complexity for us as an optical transport company is really quite severe in that jump in bandwidth. Because the problems, mostly these optical dispersion problems that we face in the fibers, go up exponentially with the speeds. At 100 gigabit, it's going to get worse. But we do have some approaches, and we're going to use either multiple wavelengths. We're going to figure out some fancy encoding schemes. The telephony guys will use some of these phase shift key modulation schemes. They're very expensive. They're very large. We don't think in the data centers that they're going to be of any practical value just because we won't be able to achieve the density. We won't be able to achieve the low power. And we've heard in spades today about the power requirements. But the issue, again, is of cost. So we have to be able to, we have to factor that all in. So what all that means is for us in terms of selecting exactly how we're going to do this, there's a process that's in process right now. The IEEE is meeting, talking about standards for 100 gigabit Ethernet, exactly which approach is going to be used to solve these problems that we can all agree on so that we have interoperability. And we expect that in 2010, the first systems will be deployed, and that's about on what we predicted from Moore's Law. So, in summary, Finisar is that optics company that supplies more optical devices than anybody else in the world. 100 gigabit Ethernet really is coming, and there's a number of us that are working frantically to try to go solve some very serious problems. But I will tell you that right now, optics is back, and the demand for bandwidth and storage is at an unprecedented rate. Thank you very much.
And now please welcome President and CEO, Luxtera, Mr. Alex Dickinson.
Thanks very much. I guess Luxtera is the answer to George's question in the last session, which is Sand Hill Road investing in solving the problem of interconnect? I think also what came out in that discussion is that CPU cycles have commoditized, memory has commoditized, but interconnect has not yet commoditized. And that's what we're doing at Luxtera. If we look at a little bit of history, in the electronics domain, we've had extraordinary levels of integration from separately packaged transistors through Noyce's early ICs to today's very large-scale CMOS circuits of order of 100 million transistors. Interestingly enough, we've had a dissimilar evolution on the optical side. So from 2006, right now, as Jerry pointed out, the way these optical modules are put together is hybrid assembly. Build a laser, build a detector, assemble it. Cost reduction typically involves moving offshore to low-cost labor countries. What we're doing at Luxtera is taking a standard silicon process. We actually use a very advanced process at Freescale Semiconductor that they build PowerPC chips with. And we bring fibers directly into the silicon, and we move light around in the silicon directly alongside the electronics. So we have electrical wires, and we have optical waveguides, all built in a standard CMOS process. There are some pretty powerful drivers, I think all of which have been touched on already. But the fact that the cost per bit of both RAM and disk is dropping exponentially. The cost per bit of fiber also drops exponentially, in particular because we can do DWDM, so we can take one fiber and put multiple wavelengths of light down it. And I think, very interestingly, wire loss is exponential. It turns out that the faster you try and drive a signal down a wire, the harder it gets to do because of the physics of the situation. And you know, in the last session, a lot was discussed about power. Just to give you an example, right now, to move optically through a 10 gig fiber uses about 1 watt of power. Right now, to do the same in copper is about 10 watts. So there's an order of magnitude improvement from going to optics and fiber over copper at 10 gig. And then last but not least, silicon CMOS always wins. In about 1995, all image devices. So electronic camera chips were built in a process called CCD, which was a specialized silicon process. But about that time also, people started experimenting with building CMOS image sensors out of standard CMOS processes. And right now, 10 years later, that's a 500 million unit a year market. It completely swamped CCDs. So the power of taking the enormous investment that we make in standard CMOS processes is really unbeatable. Right now, obviously, metro networks are optical. We're talking a little bit about local area networks and storage area networks that are undergoing transition from copper to optical. And we've seen backplanes, and this was discussed earlier, chip to chip, and even inside a chip, these things are all happening and all done in copper, of course. So it looks like this, with fiber on the left and copper wiring on the right. But as the cost of these optical connections come down, and as these drivers cause speed to continue to increase, we're going to see fiber taking all of these things over. We at Luxtera, you know, if you look at the upper right corner there, which is regarding using optics within a particular chip, we're already working with both Sun Microsystems and Hewlett-Packard on routing optical signals around inside a chip optically. That's a fair ways out. The interesting transition that's happening right now is the land-SAN transition. But I want to make it clear, this is an inevitable, just the physics and the economics of the situation make this transition inevitable over time. This is a nice little backplane shot talking about what happens at 10 gig. On the left, if you try and do it in copper right now, you get an extraordinarily difficult routing problem that's already been referred to. If you work through fiber, you get the image on the right. It's less power, less space, more reliable, virtually everything, literally everything, is an improvement as you move across to optics. 10 gig Ethernet is growing quickly. I only put this slide up to show that in around 2011, there'll be about 30 million ports shipped of 10 gig Ethernet, but 3/4 of those will be optical. So again, to emphasize the fact that unlike what we had at 1 gig, we're going to get a transition which is largely optical. I think it's clear now, you know, one of the challenges that optical modules face is they have to be assembled. They're not printed in the way that a CMOS chip is printed. This is what we're doing at Luxtera. This is an image of a chip we've just started sampling, which is a standard CMOS chip which has an optical interface built directly on it. You can see the silicon chip in the middle came out of a standard fab at Freescale, and you can see the optical connector on the left. What we're doing, the device we're sampling, takes two of these 10 gig transceivers, so electrical to optical and optical electrical, and integrates two entire 10 gig transceivers down into a single chip. We're currently sampling that to major PC OEMs and, interestingly enough, some very large consumer electronics manufacturers, and it's getting a very good reception there. A little on the technology. Most important piece of technology we have is illustrated in the upper left there, which is the ability to come into a chip with fibers from the top surface. Traditionally, to try and get into a chip optically, you had to take the wafer, dice it up, and align fibers to the side. Because we can come into the top of the chip using a very unusual technology that's built in the standard process, we can wafer probe, meaning we can take in a whole 8 or 12-inch silicon wafer and run across the top of that wafer, probing and checking whether the electrical and optical circuits are working. We can also attach lasers. Some of you may have noticed an announcement from Intel that got a lot of press earlier this week talking about silicon lasers, hybrid silicon lasers. That's a long ways out. That's a 5 to 10 year development. What we do is take lasers, which can be very inexpensive. The laser in your DVD player is about a 50 cent piece part, and we just attach them using an industry standard process to the top of the silicon. And that gives us very economical ways to inject laser light down inside the device. And then we have inexpensive optical connectors, which we attach to the side of the device. I won't go into these slides because of time, but just pointing out that we're in the very early stages of this technology. A 10 gigabit per second modulator is in the upper left, is a device that is about 4 millimeters long, which is small by optical standards, but very big by CMOS standards. Our next generation of modulator, which is in the lower left, is about 25,000 times smaller. And that's not a process innovation. It's not changing the manufacturing process. It's just that as we learn more about the physics and the architectures of these devices, we can shrink them very quickly. Already we have running in the lab a 4x10 gig device. So there was some reference to the requirements for 40 gig interconnect in clustering. This is a device that is, again, four transceiver channels. So four electrical to optical transitions, four optical electrical transitions, but also all the very complex multiplexing that's required to generate and then take four wavelengths of light that are modulated, multiplex them into a single fiber, inject them into that fiber, and also decode it coming back on the other end. That's a silicon chip that's about 8 millimeters by 8 millimeters, which is a relatively modest sized chip. Why now and why are we doing it? Very interesting physical phenomena is that chip sizes, the wire widths on chip sizes are just going through about 100 nanometers. The light we use here, where silicon is transparent, is about 1,000 nanometers. That means, oddly enough, that the structures we build in the silicon are much smaller than the size of the wavelength of light. So all of a sudden, if you have the appropriate physics tools, you can start to interfere with light in very interesting ways. But because it's in a standard manufacturing process, you can do it repeatedly and with very high yield and very economically. We've got a great team. Two of our founders from Caltech and UCLA were once referred to by some Intel folks as the dream team of nanophotonics. A very good management team, I'd like to think. We've got very high quality investors, Sandhill Road, all three of them, NEA, Seven Rosen, and August Capital. And we also have three Fortune 100 corporate investors, a mixture of chip and computer companies. And we have a very broad base of intellectual property. Just to give you some idea of where we stand compared to Intel, who we see as our largest competitor, this is a recent Intel paper. Two chips which they join together. They build their devices in a non-standard, non-production fab. They put about 10 transistors together. The lasers are lab lasers sitting on a bench, and it runs about 4 gigabits per second. This is our device where we have one chip. It's built in Freescale standard production process, about 100,000 transistors. The lasers are bumped on chip, and of course it runs at 10 gigabits per second. Intel's very focused on this area. I think for the reasons that were clear already in today's discussion. They had a big session on this at the Intel Developer Conference last week and put out this roadmap. We're obviously very excited because we think we have a big advance on them. We have done all of the elements that they talked about as relatively near-term developments in terms of testability, in terms of waveguides and modulators. We're already doing DWDM integration, so 40 gig. And as I mentioned, we're already sampling a fully integrated part. So this technology is not in the future. This technology is definitely now. We're sampling these devices now, and we'll be in full production in 2007. A brief summary. Some amazing irresistible scaling trends that are happening here. The need for bandwidth, the virtually unlimited capacity of fiber, and also Moore's law driving silicon economics. And I believe we're the first company that can take advantage of Moore's law, not just in the way that electronics are done, but the way that optics are done. It's a very manufacturable process. The fab that we use at Freescale is capable of millions of devices per week, as I said, being used currently for PowerPC devices. We can integrate in with existing CMOS circuits, so we can take a microprocessor, which is what we're doing with some of our partners, and interface an optical interface directly onto those devices. We can also build the devices in different CMOS fabs. It doesn't have to be uniquely located with Freescale, and we're currently sampling. Last but not least, I want to emphasize that this is a very interesting platform technology. So we've talked about fiber-based networking, at 10 gig, where we think we can fundamentally change the economics. We're also working with the IEEE, as is Finisar on 100 gig. We've got very high interest from consumer electronics companies over the next generations of linking set-top boxes and also game stations to video devices. They want to go to 4K by 2K by 120 frames per second, which is about 34 gigabits per second in that link from the box to the video screen. And that can't be compressed. So finding solutions to that is a very high priority for them. Unusual things like high-performance RF oscillators. If you can mix electronics and optics, it turns out you can build very stable oscillators, and you can increase the bandwidth available to people that are doing wireless data communications. And finally, and I think Andy Kessler is touching on this evening, there's an enormous nascent market for molecular diagnostic devices. Optical devices are phenomenally sensitive. We can build special resonators that are very sensitive to changes in their environment. And so we're doing experiments right now with Caltech and clinicians in taking our chips, very specially configured chips, running fluids over the top of them, and detecting basically single enzymes, which might be a cancer marker, for example, and being able to pull that out of the sample, detect it, and give feedback to a patient about that. So the applications of the technology are really unbounded. Thank you very much.
Jerry?
Jerry, my first question is for you. As I understand it, Finisar is betting a lot on 10 gig. And currently you have less than 10% of the market. What happens to Finisar's plans when you start competing against two transceivers on a CMOS chip?
Well, the real question is about time. It's about time. When will we start competing in large volumes against two transceivers on a CMOS chip? And it's hard to imagine that's going to be in, if I go to a Cisco switch. Cisco supposedly controls 80% of the 10 gigabit market today in terms of the number of ports shipped. If you listen to them, they have a pretty good idea as to what those ports are going to look like for the next 3 or 4 years. They're not planning on it being on a CMOS chip, but it's possible. And I think that what Alex was talking about the projects that they have at Luxtera are very exciting. For 20 years in optics, we've been talking about how do we integrate optics and how do we create integrated optical structures, mostly using silicon substrates, so that we can produce some of the economics that we got in silicon processes that were applied to chips. And unfortunately, getting light in and out of those structures has never been so easy. And conquering the yield problems in those processes have never been so easy. And so as a result, we have no practical solutions today. Now, Luxtera offers, I think, some exciting hope that in the next, not too foreseeable future, we're going to have some important results to indicate that, yes, it's feasible. And I think it's really novel, this whole idea of being able to launch light vertically into these silicon substrates, because that's most everybody has been trying to launch light into the plane in a planar manner through the substrates. But anyway, I don't see a lot of effect on the core business that we sell to into big networking companies, but for sure, in terms of innovative solutions for smaller, lighter, lower power things for the next generation of multi-gigabit, 10, 20, 30, 40, 100 gigabit things, I think it's clearly, we're all gonna have, if one company has it, we're all gonna have to have some approach to integrated optics.
Alex, what's your answer to that? I mean, when does your it seems as though your flagship product is the two transceiver chip. When does that become viable? You say you're going into production next year. What does that mean? Is there going to be resistance at a Cisco? Is it structural difference? Is it manufacturability?
Well, I agree with Jerry. The market is an interesting market in that Cisco is such the dominant customer in that market, and I think it makes it very difficult for module suppliers when I can't remember the technical economic name for it, but where there is really only one customer and many suppliers coming in, it's difficult. And we see it as a market that would be
would be hard for us to get into. I'm not meant to say this because I get in trouble with the marketing people, but the first product is actually going to be a four-channel product. We're sampling a two-channel product, but we're actually going to ship a four-channel product because we came to the conclusion it was about the same amount of effort, same amount of cost for us to do four channels as it is to do two channels.
Is that going to be a chip that's just twice the size, or is it?
It's kind of funny. Everything's shrinking at the same time. So compared to the two, I think the four-channel product chip will be about the same size as the two-channel sample chip that we have. We're really focused, for all the reasons Jerry noted, not so much at Cisco, for example, because Cisco, and it should be, is very cautious and conservative and is going to take its time on things like this. Mm-hmm. We're much more interested in the cluster interconnect market that was being discussed previously. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example which didn't come up, but there is a DARPA, Defense Department, is about to award $500 million program for petaflop computing. And IBM and Sun and Cray are all competing for that program, and two out of the three are going to win the program, is the general sense. And they were meant to make that decision a month ago, but it should come down any day. The key differentiator in that entire program was interconnect, because again, it's pretty clear that CPU cycles have commoditized, that RAM is almost the ultimate commodity, and that different approaches to interconnect are what is going to impact the power usage, the performance, and the economics of these petaflop machines. Mm-hmm. So we're interested in everything from 10 to 40 gigabit cluster interconnect up to terabit scale interconnect in these very large machines.
Mm-hmm. If Finisar is a leader in pluggable optics, how would your chips fit into that? I mean, that's a protocol agnostic situation. Are you a...
One of the interesting challenges of it turns out that the OEMs like pluggable modules, partly because it gives them more leverage in the sense that there's so many dynamics here. One is that right now these modules cost a lot of money. Let me give an economic example. For 10 gig switches, a couple of companies that we work with, Fulcrum and Fujitsu, now build 10 gig switch chips that provide 20 or 24 channels of 10 gig switching capability, layer two, for about $50 a channel. The problem is when you build a switch out of it and you need to plug an optical transceiver in, it costs of the order of $400 or $500 per channel for those transceivers. And so there's this odd mismatch between the cost of the electronics required for a switch and the cost of the transceiver required. Now, as you plug individual modules in, you're constrained. There's only so much you can do about these modules and the assembly of these modules. And one of the problems with modules is they're perfectly designed for one channel. And if you are starting to put more than one channel into a device, you can't really use the module model because it doesn't scale. It says, I'm going to plug one module in and another module in and another module in, and I'm going to pay for each one as I plug them in. If you're starting to integrate more and more channels together, it goes much more across to a chip model than a module model. And again, that takes considerable time for the industry to get acclimatized to that. That would be a major shift in terms of adoption for the industry. So again, we're less focused on markets where there are standards, such as the so-called MSA for modules, and more focused on markets that have shorter product cycles and adopt faster, which is really the computing industry rather than the telecom industry.
Mm-hmm. Jerry, would you like to comment on Finisar's pluggable optics and where you see that? Your lead there, and how Finisar's leadership there is an advantage in getting into 10 gig.
Well, I think the advantage that we have is that if you go through the networking equipment companies and the list of them, we're the number one optics supplier to almost every one of them, and we have a large volume factory, so we produce a lot of parts, but we're able to do it with very, very low defects per million, and we're very cost efficient. And I think that's the advantage that we have in the industry today, and I think that is a platform, is one that we come off of now. Whether at 100 gigabits we're going to end up using multi-channels in a single optical device, that's one of the things that we're all that's up for consideration right now, and that may be one of the only ways that we can control the cost of 100 gigabit interconnect. But if that's the case, we will have pluggable modules that have multiple channels. Today, we make pluggable modules that have any of the C-band or many of the L-band wavelengths that are available. So that means that a switch maker can, in any one of a 256 ports in the front of a switch, they can load 40 different wavelengths across a blade, put them in an optical multiplexer, and run over a single fiber, build a metropolitan network with a standard switch. And the pluggable optics gives them the ability to plug and personalize each port and customize it for whatever the customer application is that they're trying to solve. The distances, whether it's an add drop ring or it's a point to point high capacity network or whatever. So the whole idea of pluggable optics, I think, plays really well in the networking equipment space. The nice thing for us is that this generation of telecom equipment, now on the client side, virtually all the ports are pluggable optics, whereas back in 2000, there were no ports in the telecom equipment space that were pluggable optics. So there's you know, momentum in pluggable optics is actually quite strong right now.
Do we have any questions in the audience? Glenn?
I have a question for Jerry. Of course, your forte are pluggable optics, 1 gig, 2 gig, 4 gig, primarily for data centers. I think Cisco is your biggest customer, if I'm not mistaken. Do you see your transceivers becoming a commodity product? How do you feel your company stands up against the Asians and what they're doing with transceivers?
Well, it's hard to make 2.5 million units a quarter and not think about your product as being pretty close to being a commodity. On the other hand, in the high-speed networking and storage world, we have more than twice the market share of the next closest competitor. So though it may be a commodity, we're doing something right. And I think what we do right is we provide really good performance and performance that our customers can measure and differentiate from our competitors. We have been able to execute with very low, these defects per million parts that our customers track every quarter, and they know whether you're a good quality supplier or you're not. And we've figured out how to do that and do it really well. So, because of all of that, I think that, yes, though we operate in what many people would be consider to be a commodity market, we have really the dominant market share and I think they're the preferred supplier by most of the equipment companies just because performance and execution is so good.
Jerry, what about the part of Cisco taking your transceivers and marking them up 8, 9, 10 times and requiring their customers to buy those transceivers only. That's kind of an off the wall question, but does that help you? Does it hurt you? Is there any relevance at all?
Well, Cisco, as you pointed out, is our largest customer, and so whatever our largest customer wants to do, we gotta love it. I have read a lot about how much money they make marking up our optical transceivers and generating 80 or 90% gross margins and reselling them. And I can tell you that there's been a lot written in the industry also that in the last generation of catalyst switches, one of the things that Cisco does is they, you know, and we cooperate, we build into every one of our optics because we have a processor and memory on board in each one. We build in an encrypted code that as it's plugged into a Cisco switch, it has to go through a handshake, a song and dance, that says, are you the right guy, is this the right day, and do you have the right code? And if it doesn't have the right answer, the switch won't turn on the optics. So what that means is the bank or the airline or Google or whoever is using a Cisco product has to buy their optics from Cisco, because if they try to buy them from a distributor or from some other source, they won't turn on. So I could say that that's pretty smart on the part of Cisco, that they've been able to protect that part of the business. And actually, they built a big part of their business that way, that I think the stories we've seen recently in terms of the profit impact on the company and the revenue impact may be slightly exaggerated, but I'm sure it is substantial.
Hi, Elaine Patterson from Equinix. So I know you're working on the transceiver side of this a lot. If you consider, say, Infinera's position with their photonic integration that they've done, how long of a lead do you think they have in their market before third-party suppliers just completely take over in terms of the photonic integration on the interconnect space for DWDM fabrics?
Well, Infinera's done a lot of very clever integration work, and I think their whole... But I think the clever part of it to me is sort of the whole systems architecture of the Infinera solution. Infinera is also a very good customer of ours, so we're very enthusiastic about their future. My personal view is that to the extent that they can ramp, they're going to have a lead that's going to be, I don't know, a year or two before anybody else is going to be able to achieve something quite like they've done. So. Their economics are pretty impressive for me, I think, anyway.
If I could just comment on that, Infinera does an extraordinary amount of optical integration of lasers and modulators and muxes in indium phosphide. Indium phosphide devices are made on wafers about 2 inches across as opposed to 12 inches for CMOS. And so they actually have an extraordinarily high costs around their chip. They've been terribly clever to build a business model, a vertically integrated business model, where they're a systems supplier, and I'm sure they'll be very successful. But I don't believe that technology is able to come out into any high volume applications. I think it works perfectly for them. I don't think they've ever talked or perhaps even considered doing anything with their chips other than building their own very high value added systems around them.
So my name is Andrew Schmidt. I actually wrote the report that appeared on Light Reading about the Cisco monopsony that you guys are talking about. And I know, Jerry, you're in a difficult position to comment on that, so I'm not going to ask you. But Alex, given that you guys are doing some really interesting innovation in this area, can you talk a little bit about just some ideas how component suppliers are going to be able to claw back some of the margin that the equipment providers are currently realizing? Because I think that's what really needs to happen in this business to make it healthy again.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Again, there's this problem with the dominant provider. There's some more subtle but also annoying problems with some of the folks, not Finisar, that are providing decent volumes in optical modules have other relationships with Cisco that cause them not to have to make much margin on their modules. There's a lot of interesting pressures economically there. I guess from a Luxtera perspective, we think part of the problem is you have a number of suppliers, of which Finisar is the leader, who are using virtually identical methods for building those products that they're selling to Cisco. And that gives Cisco an enormous ability to come in and squeeze margins and strike extremely tough deals with the suppliers. We believe that, though it will take some time, the transition to CMOS photonics is going to completely change the cost base for delivering those products. And if you start looking at 4 or 8 channels in a single chip, the economics fundamentally changes and don't necessarily restore margin by being able to increase prices, but let's say restore margin by working on a much, much lower cost base per channel. And so that's how we would see ourselves disrupting that market. But I think as things stand, it's all the things that you've written about. There's assumption that there has to be consolidation in the market. But as long as the same technology, which is difficult to differentiate around, which is largely driven by laser yields and assembly costs and final test yields and final test cost, I think that market's going to stay It has to stay relatively static. Unless, again, there are some companies that are well-known and not healthy that exit, or there's consolidation. That may help, but I would suspect that that would tend to help on the margin rather than in an absolute sense.
One of the things I would comment on is that if you look back at our company 3 years ago, less than 3 years ago, our gross margins were about 20%. Right now, they're almost 40%. You know, we've gone through a long, arduous path to rebuild a company, and we did it the old-fashioned way. We built our volume, we lowered our cost, we became more vertically integrated, we owned our own factory, and we made it very, very efficient. Yeah, we're still on that path, and we're still trying to drive those margins a bit higher. There are limits. We're never going to achieve the same margins, though, that Cisco and Brocade and EMC and all those equipment companies do. I mean, we're not kidding ourselves there.
Vertical model is great when the industry's growing. What happens when there's a recession or another?
Well, the vertical model.
How do you keep your margins up?
The vertical model is great as long as you have volume. Right. And as long as we have more than twice the market share of the next closest competitor, and we can build millions of units every quarter, we got the volume that vertical integration pays off, owning your own factory pays off. If there's a downturn, if there's a severe downturn, then you know you get stuck with some fixed costs and it's not fun. I will just tell you, from what we heard from the panel today, from the Google guys and the Ask guys, what I hear from all the big financial service providers, and I just came from a Cisco meeting with Chambers and the boys here this week. There is no lack of demand or pressure right now for bandwidth, for optics and optic connectivity, or for switches to tie it all together. So,
well, it's time to break for lunch. I have one fast question, Alex. Any plans to go public?
No plans to go public, though I would say.
But you're waiting for Jerry to buy you, right? That's what it is.
I can say. I would say this week, I'm pleased to say that this week we announced that Lanny Ross, who is the ex-CEO of Broadcom and sits on Broadcom's board, just joined our board. So we're moving forward.
Thank you.
Great.
Thanks, sir. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, lunch is being served right next door in Ballroom C. Please join us for lunch.